This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If ever there was a case of love at first sight, it happened January 17, 1942, at a dance in Asheville, North Carolina. That's where 21-year-old Billy Gray met 28-year-old Private Charles Kiley. And after just a couple of weekend dates, they were in love.
February 7, 1942, Asheville. I still have to stop and wonder if it isn't all a pleasant dream, but then I have your perfume and your emblem on my coat, too. There is a certain indescribable element within me that wasn't present before. I feel almost complete. There's more than just a corner of my heart reserved. I'm sending you a picture, the one you forgot. I was afraid it wouldn't fit in your wallet, hence the folder. There's room on the other side for your other girlfriend, but you'd better not let me see.
February 16th, 1942. Fort Dix, New Jersey. Billy, I guess we both have that same lost feeling. This past Saturday night, for me, was so terribly lonesome. I would have given 10 years of my life to have you with me, if only for an hour. But then, I do have you, in the picture case next to my heart. And, as I've said before, no matter where I am and what I'm doing, I'll be thinking only of the time when I can hold you, oh, ever so tightly. Because, you see, I do love you so much, Billy Ruth. Like you, I can scarcely believe it happened. And so suddenly.
And that was the beginning of a love forged in the pages of dozens and dozens of letters between Charles and Billy as he served as a correspondent in the European theater for the Stars and Stripes. Charles and Billy's daughter, son, and son-in-law have brought these letters together in a book, Writing the War, Chronicles of a World War II Correspondent. David Kiley of Ann Arbor is their son. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little more about Charles and Billy and what they were both doing on that January 1942 when they met.
Well, you know, my father actually went into the Army as infantry, not as a reporter. He was a reporter in civilian life. He was a sports writer for the Jersey Journal newspaper and covered Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe Louis fights and, you know, the whole thing. But he went in as infantry and was doing his basic training in Camp Croft, South Carolina. And they bussed the soldiers up to Asheville for a dance, as, you know, was often the case then. My father went into the room. It was a YMCA. And he literally locked on my mother, who was in the back of the hall, like the second he walked in. And he zigzagged his way through the tables and chairs and asked if he could sit down and introduce himself. And he did. And it sounds storybook, but it really was love at first sight. And they only saw each other two more times before he trained up to Fort Dix in New Jersey, because from there he was awaiting deployment overseas. And my mother and him started corresponding immediately because there was a few phone calls, but in those days it was a lot easier to get letters from Camp Croft to Asheville than it was to call.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it's clear from your book, the very first letter he wrote was a card while she was still waiting downstairs, so he couldn't wait. And just so we get the context of this, this truly was the real thing, because how long were they married?
Well, they got married in August of 44, and my father passed away in 2001. So.
And she actually passed away?
She passed away in 2007 on their wedding anniversary, which...
Their 63rd anniversary.
It was really amazing because she always said it was not her birthday that was the most important day of her life. She always said it was her wedding anniversary. And she developed esophageal cancer the last few months of her life. And it was almost like she was hanging on to go see him on their anniversary.
You and your sister knew that there were letters. But had you read them until – at what point did you decide, okay, we're going to read Mom and Dad's letters?
I first discovered these letters in the 90s, and I can still see this Panasonic clock radio box, you know, that somebody had gotten a Christmas gift in or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the letters were all in there very haphazardly. And envelopes and whatnot. And I started looking through them, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. And from time to time, I would revisit them and just read them. But it wasn't until after my father passed away that we started really digging in, separating them, cataloging them, figuring out how to organize them, because there's over 800 letters. Many of them were handwritten. So we had to go through, and because of age, you know, we had to copy all of them and scan all of them so that we could handle them, and, you know, and this. So it was quite a project. And then it just, it built momentum over time. We didn't work at it constantly. And then my sister really kind of quarterbacked the project of the final push to get them to where we can start editing them down, because obviously they're edited letters.
Certainly. What's striking is we can see that your father was a newspaper reporter, because he really brings so much clarity to his writing.
February 25th, 1942, Fort Dix, New Jersey. I received the sweater, and Billy, you couldn't have sent anything I would appreciate more except your picture. Your letters lift me up so much. So don't ever worry about me getting too many or that they're too long. If my little remembrances make you smile or bring home the thoughts I send, it makes me happy. I want to make you the happiest girl in the world. All this may sound rather small, coming from someone who, just now, isn't in a position to make anyone happy. Still, I'd like to believe I can one day. I don't mean to get heroic or wave the flag. But I do know that what I have to do now must come first. You can understand that, can't you?
Now, you describe your mother, Billy, in the book as a girl who was kind of shy. Did writing to Charles begin to change that?
I don't think so. My mother was really shy over her whole life. She lacked a certain self-confidence, but in a really beautiful way, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
She and my father were very religious in the Catholic Church and were both very organized. My father later became an ordained deacon in the Catholic Church, and she was very much a part of that. It was something about the way she was brought up. I think her mother early on kind of put her in her place a little bit, and I don't think she ever quite got over that. But it wasn't shyness in a debilitating social way. It was just that sort of... I don't think she ever felt she was quite good enough, you know, which it just made her try harder and care for other people more, frankly.
June 6, 1942, Asheville. What better way to spend Saturday night than writing to you? As usual, I'm missing you so much, and I keep looking back to 2 months ago tonight. We had another anniversary Wednesday, but I can't help making them fall on Saturday nights. Saturday night seems so important to us. You know, we never have spent a weekday together. The news has been so encouraging today in the Far East and in Europe. Maybe it won't be so long after all.
And yet we know it would be 2 years to the day she wrote that letter before the Allies would invade Europe on D-Day, and then a nearly a year of hard fighting before there'd be victory in Europe. In the meantime, she was very, very busy keeping things up on the home front in Asheville.
June 28, 1942, Asheville. We picked our first peas and beans from our victory garden. Mom was so pleased. They just announced that 8 Nazis had been arrested for attempted sabotage. They had been landed from submarines by rubber boats. They had lists of all the places they were to bomb. I guess our FBI is on the job. 4 were landed at Long Island and 4 off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida. That's really bringing the war home. They had enough money and ammunition to last 2 years.
Your book and your mother's letters give us such a real intimate view of the home front and what that meant. She worked in a plant, then she went to work in a bank, but it's interesting to realize how much was still ahead of them while they were still thinking, well, maybe it'll be over soon and you'll be home.
Yeah, I mean, back then, people didn't think the war was going to last nearly as long as it did. And she did. She makes references to taking first aid courses, to rolling bandages, to when she moved up to New Jersey, she trained as an airplane spotter because it was on the coast, and Perth Amboy is actually right on the Jersey coast. And they needed people to patrol the coast and to be able to identify German planes or Japanese planes versus U.S. planes, and she trained for that. And she writes about having the night shift with a friend and drinking gallons of coffee and eating tomato sandwiches, which my friend Marlene, who's from South Carolina, tells me is a very Southern thing, the tomato sandwiches. So.
I'm talking with Ann Arbor writer David Kiley, who, along with Ann Kiley and Thomas Palakia, edited the letters, the hundreds of letters exchanged by David's parents, Billy and Charles. The book is Writing the War, Chronicles of a World War II Correspondent. Meantime, Charles gets sent to London and became a reporter for the Stars and Stripes, and that had a certain amount of danger.
January 17th, 1943, London. The RAF made a mass raid on Berlin last night, and it looks as if Jerry is going to repay the compliment. I can hear the AK-AK guns starting to boom a few miles away, and it appears as if the batteries in the city will open fire soon. There they go. A look out the window made me feel as though I was at the World's Fair watching the fireworks display. The planes seemed to be on the other side of the city, judging from the anti-aircraft activity. A couple of batteries started firing a few blocks from here, and, if you'll excuse me, I'll be getting out of here for the time being. On the top floor of a corner building, I'm in a very unhealthy position. And so ends our anniversary. A rather lively one.
And no matter what, those letters never stopped crisscrossing the Atlantic. And you get out of this book the fact that your father was this war correspondent for the Stars and Stripes. His letters have that macro view of the war that would be different from the letters of a soldier whose war was fought in a foxhole or from a B-17 cockpit or bomb bay. And then finally, for those who loved each other on either side of the Atlantic, came D-Day.
June 1944, at sea. We have been together in some strange places before, but I am certain this one gets first prize. I didn't intend to write until I had a better opportunity. However, as I lean against the side of the ship tonight, looking out into the gray-black night, to where you are, I want to be with you in this way at least. I am on a Liberty ship, bound for what the radio says is our beachhead in Normandy. This morning brought one of the most impressive sights I have ever seen as far as strength and merchant shipping and warships is concerned. Passing a U.S. battleship and two cruisers at a 200-yard distance, we watched them fire salvo after salvo at targets miles out of sight on land. Planes of every description have been soaring overhead in pairs, quartets, and large formations. In the distance, we heard shellfire on land. And, in the midst of it all, a chaplain spread his white altar linen over an oil-stained canvas on top of a hatch and celebrated mass. I'll have to apologize for not being dressed for a date tonight. My ensemble, from shoes to helmet, are pretty grimy.
I love the way they're talking to each other. We're having our dates, and, you know, I'm going to kiss you awake now to tell you this. And he did get that 30-day leave. Charles got back to New York, and they did get married, and so they had a few precious weeks before he headed back.
Yeah, they before he left in Easter weekend of 42, which was the last time they saw each other, he proposed marriage, and she accepted. And so he went home in August. They got married. I think the whole my mother kept the bill. It's somewhere, believe it or not. But the whole thing was like $80. I mean, it just they got married in Jersey City. He wound up covering the World Series in St. Louis while he was home, and then he went back in November '44 to cover the rest of the war up until the surrender. Where he was an eyewitness.
What was it like for you and for your sister to discover your parents in this different light, seeing them as young people before you were ever on the scene?
Well, what was really interesting for me was that the first time I started reading the letters, I realized almost, not right away, but I realized once I got into it, I felt a lot of myself in his writing. And then I realized one day that I was the same age as he was writing them. And it was like, it wasn't something I realized at the beginning. It was in the middle, and I thought, wow, because my father was 50 when I was born. You know, so when I was growing up, a lot of people thought he was my grandfather. Mm. You know, I'm 10, and he's 60, and he's got white hair, and, you know. So it was an amazing window. There were parts of him that were the same, you know, at that when he was older, but parts of him that were very different. And I was able to discover where my dad came from emotionally in his head to understand him better. And one of the things that comes out in the book is, you know, he experienced a lot of tragedy. My father's younger brother, Eddie, was killed in December in the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest in Germany. I've been to the site, and he was 24, and I think my father experienced a lot of guilt, probably never really expressed the fact that he was taken out of a combat place to be a writer. But his younger brother, who he worried about constantly, you know, was in there as infantry cannon fodder and wound up getting killed. And also his mother, my grandmother died while he was overseas. She had had a stroke shoveling snow at the age of 52 out in front of their house. And so there's a lot of tragedy. There's a lot of pain. My mother's nephew, Bill, who's still alive, developed infantile paralysis, polio. And she talks about, for people who know the history in polio, there was no cure, but there was a woman, a nun named Sister Kenny, and she refers to the Sister Kenny treatments on him. He's not well, but he's still alive today.
The book is Writing the War, Chronicles of a World War II Correspondent, and David Kiley will be at Nicholas Books in Ann Arbor to talk about the book, to sign the book November 2nd at 7 p.m., and I know you're thinking of other ways to use these letters, perhaps a dramatic treatment or a script beyond, because it really does tell the story of the war and a very beautiful and lasting love story. We also want to give a special thank you to Meredith Starkman and Graham Teckler from the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance for portraying Billy and Charles. It was great to have you with us, and we're so glad you and your sister and your brother-in-law shared these wonderful letters.
Well, thank you so much for your interest and for all those people who may buy the book and get something out of it. We're very appreciative.